We are KOWS Occidental 92.5 FM, streaming on the web at kowsfm.com.
And I'm Bernie Steffen, and this is my second show on cows, and I named it Ecologic. Today, our topic is energy limits to our industrial civilization. And I want to welcome my very, very special guest. He's Richard Heinberg. He's a senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, and he's regarded as one of the world's foremost advocates for shifting away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He's the author of 14 books, including some of the seminal works on society's current energy and environmental sustainability crises. Peak oil, peak everything, and the party's over. Those are early books from the early 2000s that I remember. And he's written hundreds of articles that have been published and republished widely. He and his wife, Janet, live in a permaculture home here in Sonoma County. Welcome to Ecologic, Richard Heinberg.
Hey, Bernie, it's good to be with you.
Well, I mentioned that you were in the early 2000s already writing books about peak oil. What brought you to this subject in the first place?
Right. Well, it really started in the early 1970s when I was reading books like Limits to Growth and Small is Beautiful and so on. I was realizing, very early in my young adulthood that our current industrial way of life is fundamentally unsustainable. And that was like a huge wake-up moment for me. And I've basically spent the rest of my career trying to figure out, how is it unsustainable? What are we doing wrong? What are the consequences likely to be? And what should we do about it? And that's led me into all sorts of different nooks and crannies of, self-education and exploration. But it was in the late 1990s when I happened on to the work of a couple of petroleum geologists who had spent their careers as exploration geologists and knew about as much about not so much the oil business, but the whole industrial process of extracting oil and turning it into useful commodities and so on, about as much as anybody on the planet. And they believed that world conventional oil was very close to its maximum rate of extraction, and that was that led me then to start looking at why is that important? Obviously, it's an energy source. Why is energy important? What are the alternatives? Where do we go from here? And so on. So that was the basis of all of my books, starting around 2003 until mid 2010s.
So obviously you discovered Hubbard. He's the fellow credited with raising peak oil.
M. King Hubbard.
Yeah.
With a T on the end.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. King Hubbard was active in the 1940s and 50s. He lived past that time, but his main contributions were in the 1950s with a series of papers in which he suggested that U.S. oil production was very close to its all-time peak, and in fact, it did start to decline starting around 1970, and declined very dramatically and pretty rapidly after that year. And he said this same thing is going to happen for the world as a whole. It isn't the problem isn't when are we going to run out of oil. It almost never happens with any natural commodity. What does happen is as we extract more and more of the stuff out of the ground and get used to using more and more, demand increases because it's useful stuff. And then it gets harder and harder to get the next increment of oil or natural gas or coal or silver or gold or whatever it is. It gets harder to get that next increment of the stuff out of the ground. It takes
costs
more energy.
More.
Yeah, it costs more money. It costs more manpower. It costs more energy.
Yeah.
And so...
you taught me that term, energy return on energy investment.
Right.
And it made so much sense that we come to a point of, well, there's no more business opportunity. It's over. It isn't like we've run out of it. It's we've run out of the ability to extract it in a way that you can get financing for.
Right. And this is particularly relevant when we talk about global coal supplies, because a lot of times people say, oh, well, you know, there's massive amounts of coal out there. And yeah, there's still a lot of coal that hasn't been mined. But a lot of countries have counted coal that, you know, it's in the ground, but it would take too much effort to get it out of the ground. It would cost too much to extract it. Yeah. So it's never really going to be like there's coal under seabeds, for example. And maybe somebody could develop the technology to get that out, but it's going to be very sophisticated technology, very expensive. We don't have it now. So counting that coal as reserves is really kind of a fiction.
Yeah. Well, I remember one of the indicators early on that indeed there was already being close to the peak, if not at it, is that there was a delay from when you started to invest in deciding where to drill to about 40 years before a well was in place and the energy was flowing.
Well, yeah, it's usually not that long. But
okay,
yeah.
But whatever that length is, people were looking at that, and the people requesting, to get money or funding for more exploration, that was on the decline.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So they could see the future wasn't there.
Yeah, global oil exploration, I mean, that's not the right term. Global oil discoveries have been declining since the 1970s. And so every year we discover maybe one new barrel of oil for every 10 barrels of oil that's consumed. Obviously, that can't go on forever.
Yeah.
So we're living off the legacy of exploration that took place in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s right now.
I love when you use the term, obviously, that can't go on forever. Well, I was a physics major and a math major, and I understand what that means.
Yeah.
Obviously, anything that is of limited quantities, I mean, I remember as a child my parents telling me the ocean was sort of infinite, and whatever you put in there would get cleaned up, you know. But as I got older, I realized that was a lie. That was a fantasy. And so yet there's a lot of our society that acts like, fossil fuels are still out there. We're still going to get them. In fact, we'll even invade other countries if we have to, but we're going to keep the oil flowing because that's what we know. That's what is. And so when you wrote The Party's Over, not everybody heard that or believed it. And they might say, Richard, were you wrong? Because people are still partying.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I was partly wrong. The folks I was listening to were saying that world oil production would likely peak in the first decade of this century, sometime around 2005. And if you read them closely, what they were talking about was conventional petroleum, the kind of stuff that we relied on throughout the late 19th and throughout the 20th century. Now, actually, that did happen. Global conventional oil production flatlined starting around 2005. But what happened after that is that some new technology enabled the extraction of lower quality oil deposits that exploration geologists had sort of put aside on the back burner, believing that it would be too difficult and expensive to get the stuff out of the ground.
And that's like tar sands and shale?
Different kinds of resources, including the Canadian tar sands, the extra heavy oil of Venezuela, and also the what's in the business called light tight oil, which is produced by hydrofracking and horizontal drilling.
Yeah.
And that's come on strong here in the U.S. The U.S. Had been declining dramatically, as I said earlier, since the 1970s in oil production. And starting right around 2010, U.S. oil production shot up and in a way that we've never seen before in any country in modern history. And today, the U.S. is once again the world's foremost oil-producing country. And it looks like the problem of peak oil has been totally solved. However,
yes, I know this. I know it's coming. That fracking bubble, if you will, or peak, is very short-lived.
Yeah.
Once that's done, then we invent something else that we don't know about yet?
Well, the problem is the nature of the resource itself. Light tight oil, as the name suggests, tight oil. It's bonded in very low permeability rocks, often shale, and to get the oil out of the ground, oil companies use explosives. They drill horizontally through the shale. They try to get as much contact as possible between the well bore and the the layer of shale that has this light tight oil in it. And the result is they get a lot of oil out of the ground very quickly from each well, but then each well depletes very rapidly compared to conventional oil wells. So that means they have to drill a lot of wells.
Could you pause one sec?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think people like to know, what is a conventional oil well duration look like? You know, how many years is it productive typically?
Yeah, well, it depends, but often, 10, 20, 30 years or perhaps even longer.
And this fracked period of time in comparison?
Well, typically with a tight oil well, 60% of total eventual production will happen within the first 2 years. And then it'll trail off pretty rapidly after that. So, yes, there are fracked wells that were drilled back in the early 2010s that are still producing, but at a very, very low rate. So, as I was just about to say, they've had to drill hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of wells over the last 15 years in order to make this miracle happen. This is true in the natural gas world, too. The U.S. has become the world's foremost natural gas producer again after seeing declines in natural gas production. And again, it's due to this new technology of fracking. And again, the wells deplete very rapidly, and they have to be drilled in order to keep production steady, much less increasing.
I'm going to ask you a question, not that I have, but I think a lot of people have as well. Why can't we believe that our ingenuity, this new technology that we keep discovering, won't come along and squeeze even more out of the planet?
Right. Well, at the end of the day, we get back to what you brought up earlier, the energy return on energy invested. Technology is... It seems to be magic often, but it's still physics. And if it costs energy to get energy, then that equation of how much it costs is, at the end of the day, that's what's most important. So fracked oil, fracked natural gas, they require high prices, high gas and oil prices in order to work. Right now, with oil at $60 a barrel, folks in the fracking industry are chewing their fingernails because they're really not making much profit. They want to stay in business. They're hoping the price of oil goes up. 20, 30 years ago, $60 a barrel oil was expensive oil. Now, not so much. We've gotten used to a different regime. And these sources are set now to turn over. And this isn't just the view of the sort of oil and gas pessimists. The U.S. Department of Energy, even in the Trump administration, which is so bullish on fossil fuels, is now saying that U.S. tight oil production is set to start declining this year, 2026, and U.S. shale gas production will start declining before 2030.
I'm not hearing that on mainstream media.
Yeah, you know,
that
depletion.
Message, it seems like it's important.
Depletion is not a word you ever hear in mainstream media. It's just never discussed. And yet, if you're in the business of extracting stuff out of the ground, depletion is happening all the time, and it constrains what you can do now and what you can do in the future. Depletion is a fact of life for modern industrial civilization, and it's one that we have banished from our thoughts, and it has not just to do with fossil fuels, but also, as we'll talk as we go on, with the minerals that we use to make the alternative energy sources, including uranium and all the minerals we use to make solar panels and wind turbines and so on.
I'm totally with you, and I'm looking forward to that. Remind the listeners that I'm speaking with Richard Heimberg, and we're talking about energy limits in our industrial civilization. And now I'd like to hear a word from our sponsors.
Board certified in a broad spectrum of physical and integrative medicines, as well as prolotherapy. His offices are located at 95 Montgomery Drive in Santa Rosa. You can find out more at westcountyintegrativemedicine.com.
Cows would like to thank Barrel Proof Lounge in Santa Rosa for their underwriting support. Located at 501 Mendocino in the Brickyard Center, they feature live music, karaoke, trivia, comedy, and more. Their website is barrelprooflounge.com, and they can be found on Facebook and Instagram.
So we're back. This is Bernie Steffen with Ecologic. My guest here is Richard Heimberg, and we're talking energy. So we've got to a point of understanding, at least admitting, even in the Trump administration, that fossil fuels will go away, and we're not going to human ingenuity through technology. That's not something to keep pursuing. That's over. So we got to go to something else. Now, there's been this belief that, oh my God, all we have to do is tap into the sun. That's unlimited energy. We can tap into wind and tides. And there are all of these ways we can get renewable energy and continue living the way we're living. What do you say to that?
Oh, that's a big discussion. I co-wrote a book on this subject, Our Renewable Future, with David Fridley, who's probably the best energy expert I know. He was on the energy analysis team at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And what we did was imagine, okay, what would it take to get all of our energy from renewable sources, and we took a year to do analysis and kind of our focus group of two going back and forth, me asking questions and David doing the analysis. And what we came up with is, you know, a lot of things are possible in principle. You know, it's possible in principle to run airliners on hydrogen and make the hydrogen from solar panels, from water, using electricity from solar panels. And, you know, you could go on and on. All the ways we use fossil fuels now and all of the alternative technologies that we could replace them with. And some of those are happening, like electric cars. I drove here to the recording station, the radio station, in my handy-dandy electric car. Works great. Much prefer it to fossil fuel cars that I've owned in the past. And that said, I think few of us realize how huge a challenge it actually is, what we're talking about. We're talking about electrifying most of industrial society. Solar panels and wind turbines produce electricity, which is great. Electricity is a very versatile energy carrier. However, Our current energy system is only about 20% electricity.
Oh, I thought it was higher than that.
And the other 80%, we use fossil fuels directly for heating, for industrial processes, for transportation, and all sorts of things. So replacing that 80% of our current energy usage that is done with fossil fuels directly, that's going to be by far the biggest industrial project in all of human history. It dwarfs anything even remotely comparable. And it's going to be extremely expensive, and it's going to require a lot of energy. You know, building all of those electric cars, solar panels, wind turbines, heat pumps, on and on and on, takes energy. And where's that energy going to come from? Well, at least in the initial stages, almost all of it's going to come from fossil fuels.
Yeah, well, there's no question that that is, like we were talking about fracking before, extended the lifetime of an oil well. Mm-hmm. This is a way to extend the lifestyle we've been living based on fossil fuels by having fossil fuel extenders, I'll call these renewable resources, because none of them come without there being fossil fuels. I can't imagine, and maybe some people imagine it, that a wind farm is going to grow all that's needed to do the mining and manufacturing of the next baby wind farm. And that doesn't even count the idea that the ecological destruction that's happening in a wind farm or in a solar farm or what have you. So I think people are fantasizing that we can swap out the supply, because what's the alternative? Reducing our demand. So instead of you driving here with your electric car or me driving here with my hybrid car, we could be biking or walking.
Well, when David and I did the analysis on the energy transition from fossil fuels to renewables, we found it was almost impossible to make that transition work without a substantial reduction in overall energy usage. And when I say substantial, I'm talking about 70 to 90% reduction in overall energy usage of society. If we did that, then the replacement of one energy source, or you know, the suite of energy sources that we call fossil fuels, with a different suite of energy resources, renewables, becomes feasible. But without that reduction in overall energy usage, not so much. Now here we are, you know, in 2026, and what's actually happening? We're seeing a dramatic increase in demand for electricity, not for making solar panels, not for, you know, electrifying all the things we do with fossil fuels, but for data centers.
Yes.
For AI. So this is throwing a huge monkey wrench in the gears of a process that was already enormously challenged from the get-go.
Our society is not dealing with that reality. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and most scientists would have to admit that is the evidence that we have to reduce our demand. But we've been reducing our demand in really tiny little ways. We can ban straws in restaurants, but not in fast food. Mm-hmm. We can ban the use of plastic bags if they're single use. You know, but we can't bring ourselves to ban all plastic, to stop all drilling, to stop all... We can't bring ourselves to say goodbye to industrial civilization because we are fully engulfed in it.
Right. Well, it's you could say it's partly human nature. You know, nobody wants to give stuff up, but it's also systemic. You know, our current economic system, including schools of economics, the economic theories that are taught in those schools, our economic system in terms of, you know, how investment works and the expectation of returns on investments, how the stock market works. All these things grew up during this totally anomalous period of the last century and a half, when the economy was growing relentlessly because we had more energy. This is what people don't get, that energy is the economy.
Right.
Without energy, nothing happens.
And energy enables complexity. And
right.
our industrial civilization is becoming ever more complex. And we know that all complex civilizations eventually collapse, from Joseph Trainer and his
studies. Yes.
And so we know that this is an exponential curve, and it's something, it's hard to get off this roller coaster.
Right. Yeah, and as I was saying, we have all these assumptions about how things should work.
Yeah.
That are just based in our own experience, you know, because we've all grown up during this anomalous period of time of rapid economic growth. Before fossil fuels, 70 to 90% of the population in most countries worked at farming, because that's how many people it took on the land to produce enough surplus so that that other 10 or 20% of the population could live in cities and be, you know, doctors or accountants or kings or whatever they were. And now less than 1% of the population can work full-time at farming and produce enough food surplus. Why is that? Because we have tractors, combines, all these giant machines running on fossil fuels that can produce that kind of surplus. Plus, we have agricultural chemicals made from fossil fuels, pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, et cetera. So what happened as a result of this immense switch in food production was that most of the population was freed up to move away from the farms into cities. So during the 20th century, the biggest demographic trend was urbanization. When people move to the cities, they're looking for manufacturing jobs. We can manufacture a lot of stuff now because we have all this energy.
Yeah.
And we can put people to work full time as inventors to invent new technologies to manufacture. And so this is how economic growth worked and how we became deluded to think it was perfectly normal and natural and could go on forever. But the thing is, we live on a finite planet. So nothing grows forever on a finite planet. And this was the insight, the absolutely blistering insight of the Limits to Growth study that came out in 1972, which foresaw exactly the situation that we're in right now in the early to mid 21st century.
You mentioned economic study as it is today. One of the things that I think has been left out of our economics is the cost to the environment. Mm. We've monetized most everything, but a tree, its lumber is valued by how much can be cut out of that tree,
right. But
not what the opportunity cost killed for that tree is in terms of providing habitat for other species and health for our ecosystem and watershed.
Yeah. Well, in a society that's growing fast, the tendency is to have a very short time frame for, you know, understanding where you are in the universe and what the past is and what the future is. It's societies that have been in one place for a long time and bumped up against environmental limits many times. Those kinds of societies, we call them indigenous societies.
Yes.
Those societies learn how to live within limits sustainably, and they have a long time horizon. They make their decisions for the seventh generation in the future. We're making our decisions for the next quarterly profit.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of short-termism is coming back to bite us.
Well, I think there is a movement to recognizing the sustainable examples that indigenous cultures have shown through millennia, but also in the current where they're still existing. Unfortunately, the colonialism of our industrial civilization has wiped out a lot of the indigenous cultures.
And is continuing to do so, yeah.
And evolution, in order for our human species to continue, requires diversity.
Mm-hmm.
That diversity was always there when people lived with the land, with the other species. I think indigenous means of the land. So that's how all of the cultures, including our industrial civilization that may have flourished in Europe and got started. That came out of that also, but it got caught up in, we are now so smart and we can now have technologies that can take over other areas and deplete their resources and use them for our benefit, and therefore we have power and can rule. And so that whole model is what we are left with today. But I guess I think you would agree that we are at the end of that model. So industrial civilization will collapse. It's just a question of when, how it unravels, and what it looks like in the process.
Right, yeah. Collapse is a scary word.
Yes.
And it, for a lot of folks, once they hear it, they stop thinking. It's like, okay, collapse, that's end of story. You know, everything falls apart instantly, and that's it. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, societies have been collapsing for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, and we've had economic collapses that some people say is, well, I might as well kill myself because all my money was tied up in that stock market or whatever that just went to zero, and they think their life is over. Well, just because that way of life, that way of providing for ourselves in, you know, the industrial ways— that because that collapses, it doesn't mean we as people have to collapse, because we can adjust our demands. We don't need the homes we have. We don't need the food from around the world. We do need to eat. We do need health. We do need shelter. We do need basics. And I admire some young people who purposely go find a place to live off the grid and try to live by providing for themselves, becoming self-sufficient. Now, it's very, very hard to do. And I remember when I was younger, groups of people were motivated to do that, do these communes, but they always collapsed because there weren't enough people to carry out the trash or whatever was the...
Yeah, it was a little more complicated than that ex-member of a intentional community.
Well, I could tell you more stories about that. Complexity, yeah. So I'm sorry I disparaged it, yes.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It's a lot to learn from the communitarian movement. What we will undoubtedly experience over the next few decades is a simplification of society. And a lot of things that we take for granted now will be falling away. And we will relearn how to do a lot of things our ancestors knew how to do. And we will live in different kinds of social arrangements. One of the most exciting ways of rethinking and re-understanding sociality, I think, is the notion of bioregionalism, organizing ourselves according to our bioregions rather than the kinds of arbitrary political boundaries that we're so used to in the modern world.
Yeah.
It's how people lived up until the modern industrial period.
I call that living local.
Yeah, it's living locally, much more locally, and living in a way that's appropriate to the ecosystems that you're actually depending on.
Yeah. I want to take this opportunity, and I'm sorry I didn't mention it before, but I have a phone line here that is available. If you would like to join our conversation, ask Richard a question, or just chime in on what we're talking about, this would make the program a lot more interesting to have another point of view come in. So the number is 707-755-9250. So 707-755-9250. That line is free right now, and I'd love to hear you, caller, if you're at all interested in this subject that I think is pretty relevant to our lives right now. So, Richard, one part that I'd like to get back to was that we think that, okay, we can use less energy by becoming more energy efficient. So we get more miles per gallon in our car, and we get more miles per kilowatt on our batteries. And what there's a fellow named Jevons that thought about that a long time ago. What would he say about our belief that by becoming ever more efficient, we can still have what we have now and use less energy?
Yeah. Well, Stanley Jevons was an economist in the mid-19th century, a British economist, and his area of study was coal. And of course, in the mid-19th century, Britain ran on coal, and it was the biggest coal economy in the world. But what he was seeing was that as coal was produced more efficiently, what that resulted in was higher rates of extraction of coal and therefore faster depletion. So he saw that there was a paradox there. Rather than efficiency resulting in conservation, efficiency was actually resulting in higher rates of extraction and use. And we see the same basic pattern from Jevons' time all the way up to the present. If you make lighting, for example, more efficient. We've just gone through this big transition in the last 20 years from incandescent light bulbs to compact fluorescents and now LEDs. And LEDs are much, much more energy efficient than incandescent lights. So are we saving the same, you know, this vast amount of money on lighting? Well, not exactly, because what we're doing instead is we're lighting so much more stuff. We've put LEDs everywhere. You look at any piece of equipment in your house, it's got an LED light on it. Even, you know, if even an extension cord, you want to plug it into the wall so you can plug other stuff into it, it's got its own little LED. And instead of saving, you know, vast amounts of energy, yes, there are some energy savings from LEDs, but the Jevons paradox is eating away at that.
Yeah,
I've experienced
that for myself. I had a little truck, a Honda Ridgeline that I loved, but I was getting 20 miles to the gallon. And I was thinking, well, I need to get something more energy efficient. So I got a Kia Niro. It's the Korean Prius, I see it call it. But it was a good little car, getting 50 miles to the gallon. Guess what? I drove more miles. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm getting this really cheap now. Like, yes, the price went up, but my miles per gallon is so much better. So I rarely think about, well, but those tires on the road, they're costing. They're getting down to a point where I may have to put new tires on. There's the idea that when I'm on the road, I'm requiring another lane on Highway 101 to be built. Yeah. I take this infrastructure for the car for granted, and I only think in terms of I still can live a life that is car distance away, you know, in an hour or something like that. So
energy efficiency is still good.
It's still important.
But we need to make our stuff more efficient, but it's not a complete solution to the problem.
Yeah, and it fools us. Mm-hmm. I think it lulls us into the idea that technology will again save us.
Right.
I find that pernicious.
Yeah, and there's another kind of efficiency that really is pernicious, and that's what's called economic efficiency. Because ask any economist, you know, if you can grow corn cheaper in Iowa than any place else, well, what should you do about that? Well, obviously, grow more corn in Iowa, grow all of your corn in Iowa, maybe. And why bother growing anything else in Iowa except corn? Because that's the most economically efficient way to do it. And we've organized our whole economy that way. That's what globalization is all about.
Yeah.
But what results from that is an extremely fragile system. Because going back to the example, if the corn crop fails in Iowa, then nobody's got corn and Iowa has nothing, right?
Yeah.
So that's the the problem that we're setting ourselves up for with more and more economic efficiency. Instead, we should be looking at relocalization and community resilience. And those things require redundancy,
yes,
which is just the opposite of economic efficiency. And so, yeah, maybe you pay more for some things. Maybe it's inconvenient. Maybe you have to do without in some cases. But you're building up the resilience of your community, which is what you really rely on in the final analysis.
Yeah, it's a matter of priorities. If your priority is to accumulate more wealth in your lifetime, that's one priority. To make sure that future generations of humans have a future and are there, that's a different priority. Mm. And that's the priority that I, as a grandpa, I'm sure you and most people have, but sometimes it gets trumped by the immediacy of what it's doing to me economically in the short term in the system we're in. But that And you used a very polite word of it's fragile. Well, it's non-resilient. Mm-hmm. And if something's non-resilient, there's a higher probability that it won't last.
Right.
And we've talked about that there's almost certainty that eventually this industrial collapse will happen. How, we're not going to speculate, and when is, you know, hard to anticipate, but that it'll happen. And the idea that we shift our priorities to thinking longer term, to think about future generations, and allow for some inefficiency that comes from the redundancy. You know, that is so vital in every way, including in evolution, mm-hmm. because if we want to shortcut to human extinction, stay with the industrial model, because it's putting all your eggs in one basket and you're subjecting all the other species, including all the other humans on the planet, to what you're bringing yourself down with. Mm-hmm. If you want to preserve a future for our species, which I put as the highest order of business, you need a new economics. You need an economics that we talked about that is not just about money and everything that's monetized in our system, but it is really on the less number of extinctions of other species that are happening, what's happening to endangered populations in terms of numbers and them going up. And I used to muse to myself, and I'm going to say it out loud here, when we had a flood in Sonoma County, I went out and I took some video, and I was thinking about how we view flooding as a hazard. And I'm a realtor, and so we get flood insurance. It's a negative because it impinges upon our home potentially and a cost. And it's like wildfire. These are hazards, natural hazards. But we don't see the other side to it. The flooding that happens in the Santa Rosa Plain brings nutrients that come down and that wash over the plain to the ecosystem and the watershed that is the Laguna de Santa Rosa, that when earlier settlers came, they didn't see the value of that. I mean, they saw the possibilities for the agriculture that they were used to. And so they thought in terms of marshland, wetlands, kind of get in the way. Let's fill them in. Let's not have flooding. Let's channel Santa Rosa Creek here to go out in a straight line. And then complain that flooding has happened. We are not seeing the benefits of that natural system at work. I see a little hope, like the Klamath River just celebrated the last hydroelectric dam being taken down. We have one river, I think the Smith River, that is undammed in California. We have huge projects to move water and to dam water all throughout California. But to give up on that system and rely instead on the local watershed, where you make sure that it's as clean as possible because you're drinking from it, you're carrying water from it, or you're diverting from it for your crops. We haven't made that shift, and it's because we don't know enough about honoring the watershed that we live in, the ecosystem that's here, that's still here. Yeah, so let me take another quick break here and make sure that people understand I'm talking to Richard Heinberg, and we're talking energy limits, and calls are still welcome. We have time. Would love to hear from you at 707-755-9250.
House thanks Rick Shubb at locally owned and operated Shubb Capos. Shubb has been providing musicians around the world with industry standard capos since 1974. You can find out more about this venerable Sonoma County company on their website, which is shubb.com.
A big cow's thanks goes out to Heidi at shipshapesystems.com for her support of community radio. Heidi works to help clients bring body, mind, and spirit in harmony using a process called conscious connected breathing. To find out more about her service, you can visit shipshapesystems.com.
We thank Mac Daddy Repairs for their ongoing support. They are a West County computer and phone repair center featuring on-site and remote support. They're located at 301 North Main Street in Sebastopol and can be reached by email at support@macdaddyrepairs.com or by phone at 707-861-9403.
Cows Thanks Font.
So this is Bernie Steffen with Ecologic, our second show on this station. And our guest today is Richard Heinberg, and his expertise is around energy, fossil fuels and alternatives, and a lot of consequences that come from that. So I appreciate that we've been talking both at the detail level about the fossil fuels running out, that the renewables have potential, especially on paper, but the investment would need to come from abandoning the use of the fossil fuels to shift them into the creation of the electrified alternatives.
Right. What we're actually seeing right now is, with regard to climate change, the world has taken climate change as an enormous threat and challenge. And of course, we know that there have been annual meetings of the IPCC to address this, and nations have made targets of reducing emissions and so on. What's actually happening is that emissions are still growing, even though solar and wind electricity production has been growing very rapidly, dramatically. Solar's been getting much cheaper. There's a lot of good news, but at the end of the day, the climate only cares about whether emissions are going up or going down. And so far, emissions are going up. And why is that? It's because of the insistence on economic growth. Because the economy is growing at 3.5% per year, the global economy. That means we're using roughly the equivalent amount of increased energy. And only part of that is coming from these rapid increases in electricity from solar and wind. And then, of course, the 80% of energy usage that is direct fossil fuel use, that's increasing too. So at the end of the day, and this is... this is the fundamental problem, because we want to maintain economic growth while we make this energy transition, right? But the manufacturing of all of the new electric and renewable technologies is going to take energy. Most of that's going to come from fossil fuels in the early stages. So we have increased carbon emissions baked into that scenario. And the only way to get away from that, the only way to avoid that, is to actually simply reduce energy usage. And, okay, what does that look like? We've seen that in history on a few occasions. For example, the 2008 financial crisis, the COVID pandemic of just a few years ago, the Great Depression. These were instances where global carbon emissions declined. So if you're in favor of having a stable climate, you're also, in effect, in favor of having economic recessions or depressions. Now, politicians don't want to talk about this. People in the energy world don't want to talk about it because it's so gloomy. It's like, okay, we don't want to have climate change. That's, you know, that's the end of the world. It's horrible stuff. Imagining, you know, coastal cities being drowned and so on. But what's the alternative? Everybody wants to think the alternative is continuing to live exactly the way we are now, only with solar panels instead of gas stations. And it's not that simple. We need to figure out how to have a long recession. In other words, simplifying and reducing the scale of the economy without the human cost of people being thrown out of jobs, going hungry, and all of the things that happen in when we have an economic depression.
You're aptly pointing out that both our economic system and our political system are so baked into this fossil fuel industrial civilization that it can't really maneuver out of it, and we don't want to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's going to come about because people go, aha, I listened to Richard and Bernie, and I think I'm going to now get off the grid and live, you know.
Right.
We're not trained for that.
There are discussions around the fringes.
Yeah.
About degrowth,
yeah.
And it, especially in Europe, there's a pretty big degrowth movement. Donut economics. Kate Raworth, who's a European economist, has written a brilliant book about how we could make a more circular economy that would, instead of having growth as its main goal, you know, a good life. You know, why do we always aim for economic growth instead of aiming to meet human needs not just for stuff, but also for happiness and connection with other people in our communities. And if we oriented our economic system around those goals, then even as we have less energy throughput, less economic throughput, we could actually enjoy ourselves more. I mean, how happy are people right now in our current situation?
I remember when Europe was way ahead of us in terms of wanting to put taxes on fossil fuels to make sure that the transition to the newer, cleaner technologies would happen. And France invested heavily, I believe, in nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. And over time, those things have obeyed, and they've recognized that nothing compares to fossil fuels. And the economics that we have and the political systems we have, they can't get us out of this box. So I fear, and I believe, that we're not going to solve this problem looking to global solutions. We're going to have to let go of industrial civilization as it collapses and sort of accept it mentally and move forward to more indigenous living, more bioregional living, more local living, more simple living. And that means giving up on mobility. People say, yeah, but I need a car to get to work. Yeah, but what if you don't have a job? Then you don't need the car, right?
So, right. So, well, the bioregional vision is, you could call it a long-term goal. That's the North Star. That's what to have in mind as we make all the decisions that we will be making over the next 2, 3, 4 decades. Industrial civilization isn't going to go away all at once. If it did, you know, billions of people would die very shortly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be a process of simplification, of relocalization, more and more lengthy economic recessions, and until we get to a point where we actually are living within Earth's limits.
Yeah,
that's a long ways away at this point.
But I think it's worth holding a priority for that, to getting there sooner rather than later, because mm-hmm. I think we're on the verge of actually threatening mass extinction.
Right.
And to me, that's such a horrendous outcome from this species having been evolved with so much intelligence and not using it correctly here to the purpose of maintaining our species. Now, you mentioned population. I'm understanding from experts that 8 billion is too many, and maybe 1 billion is more like it. So losing 7 billion needs to be in our thinking, not that we want people to die, but we also have a lot of investment these days in longevity. Mm-hmm. Both my parents died in their 50s. I'm already 77, and when I got to 60, I thought I was an extra life, but I've had cancer surgery, et cetera, et cetera. And we extend life over and over again with miracle investments in medical technology. But is that really in our future?
Right.
Can that be sustained?
Population is another subject that we could certainly spend the rest of our time on, but I need to say just a few things about it.
Yeah.
Yes, the world is certainly overpopulated with 8.3 billion human beings right now. And a few courageous people have been pointing that out for a long time, but that subject has got, politically, that subject has gotten radioactive. Meanwhile, something has been happening inside the statistics. The trend has shifted to the point where fertility is declining in most countries around the world, and the global population is going to peak much sooner than projections were saying, even just 10 or 20 years ago. Now, that's a good thing, but why is population peaking? Some of it is mysterious. Some of it, yes, can be ascribed to, well, as people get richer, it gets more expensive to have, you know, another child because you want to send them to good schools and so on. So the demographic transition, which demographers have been talking about for decades, is a real thing. And as nations get wealthier, families tend to get smaller. But other things are going on too. Younger people are looking at the world situation and they're saying, is this a world that I want to bring a lot of children into? And they're questioning that. And then still another thing that's going on is that we're flooding the world with toxic chemicals, including hormone-mimicking chemicals that are causing male sperm counts in humans, but also in other species, to decline rapidly.
Yeah.
And that's actually one of the reasons that we're seeing declines in insect populations, bird populations, and so on. But it's now hitting human beings as well.
Yeah. So we set in motion things that are going to aid in this collapse or reduction to a more sustainable way. I'm going to have to end the show very soon.
Okay.
But first, I want to thank you, Richard. You are a wealth of information. And I'm so glad you were willing to come on the air here today.
Sure.
And I want to let listeners know who want to know more about you. I know of two places they can go. Resilience.org is a good place, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's I work for a nonprofit think tank called Post Carbon Institute, and Resilience.org is our sort of public website that's updated every day with fabulous articles and essays from people around the world who are thinking about these issues that we've been talking about for the last hour. And then I also have a personal website, richardheimberg.com, that has an archive of hundreds of articles that I've written, as well as, you know, links to my books and some YouTube lectures and so on.
And postcarbon.com is also...
Postcarbon.org.
.org is also a website with a lot of good information about books and the people that are like you researching in different areas.
Yeah, we've published quite a few research papers and reports and so on that go into much more detail about the kinds of things we've been talking about. I would recommend, just as one of them, Welcome to the Great Unraveling. It's you can download a free PDF of that, and it's a brilliant, I think, overview of what's now being called the polycrisis.
So, listeners, I thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the program. Take advantage of checking out some of those sites that Richard's talking about, because there's a wealth of good information there. And again, thank you. And in 2 weeks, we'll have another version of this show.